Hello, and good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming out on a bit of a mucky night here in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, to join us at Perimeter Institute and the Quantum to Cosmos Festival, celebrating Perimeter Institute's 10th anniversary. My name is John Matlock, Director of External Relations and Outreach here at the Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you and to welcome everybody tuning in online or on demand from all around the world. Now, tonight's topic is on science communication. Many of us learn about science through the news media, but the very craft of science journalism is changing, much like the science itself changes and advances and progresses. And we're going to learn a little bit about that tonight from the journalists, many of them, who bring you the news on TV, newspapers, radio, and so forth. So get ready for a very interesting discussion. Following this discussion, we invite you upstairs to Perimeter's Black Hole Bistro tonight if you'd like to enjoy the ambiance of the Black Hole. For those online, we don't have a webcam up there, but you can imagine. Everybody here in the theater, you're welcome to come up and carry on the conversation with us upstairs after tonight's presentation. Now, before we begin, would those of you in the audience please turn off any Blackberries or cell phones? We don't need anything beeping at us. Also, if you're online, this is your opportunity now to email a friend or colleague that the presentation is about to begin. If you're online, you can submit your questions through the blogs that you'll see on the site, and they'll be forwarded to Jennifer Dodd here in the theater in Waterloo, and we'll read them here for the panel. In the audience, if you have a question during the Q&A portion of the event, there'll be a microphone positioned right down here beside the podium, and we'll ask you to make your way down the stairs and speak directly into the microphone, and we'll hear from as many people as we can to maximize our time. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce our host, Catherine O'Hara. Professor O'Hara holds the CTV Chair in Science Broadcast Journalism at Carleton University in Ottawa. She's worked for over 25 years in radio and television as a host, reporter, producer, and researcher, mainly in public broadcasting. She is also the president of the Canadian Science Writers Association. Please welcome Professor Catherine O'Hara.
Thank you, John. That's good. Well, hello and welcome to all of you. This is indeed a pleasure to be here at the Perimeter Institute. It's been 10 days of remarkable science communication, I must say, and I've seen very, very, very strong science and science communication on the part of scientists, which is not all that common, I have to tell you. As journalists, we face this quite often. How do you get scientists to explain things in a way that's comprehensible to the average Joe, meaning the average journalist as a rule? And it hasn't been easy, but I must say it's getting easier all along. And science news is getting easier to get your hands on now, too. It used to be, if you were interested in science, you had to wait for a program to come on radio or television. Your morning newspaper or your afternoon newspaper may have had science content in it. It may have arrived on your doorstep. Now you can access this information anywhere. Admittedly, the standard traditional media is the first place to get a lot of this because it's still informing a lot of the areas online. But there's many other opportunities now. The universe is expanding, as we've learned all this week, and so is the blogosphere. It keeps on growing and growing and growing. And we're going to look at some of those issues tonight, where you get your science news from, where you might get it from in future. We know this is a transformational time for journalism outlets. The for-profit model doesn't seem to be working so much, and science is disappearing in some cases from our newspapers. Science journalists are disappearing from that beat. The Toronto Star did not replace its science journalists when he retired. The Canwest chain, Tom Spears in Ottawa, now does general reporting and not science reporting. The radio and television seems to still have good science programming on it. That's one thing that's really positive. But we have to admit, times are changing, and transformational times are always exciting, but there's also things to be aware of. And I think tonight we're going to have a very fascinating discussion with four people who are really in the know on these subjects, and I'm eager to introduce them to you. Nadia Alawadi is a science journalist based in Cairo, Egypt. She has worked for Islam Online, and she is currently the president of the World Federation of Science Journalists and also teaching journalism at the Haram Canadian University in Cairo. Ivan Semenek who you've probably seen a few times before if you've been following closely the Perimeter Institute's Q2C. And Ivan is the journalist in residence with the Dunlop Institute of Astronomy at the University of Toronto. Prior to that, he actually was the U.S. Bureau Chief for New Scientist magazine, a weekly science magazine. And before that, he worked at the Ontario Science Center many moons ago. So he's come from science into journalism, and he's sort of toggling academia and science now as well. And Véronique Morin, our next panelist, is from Montreal. She is a freelance science journalist, which is a very difficult task these days. Currently, she is a reporter, a science reporter, for the Code Chastanet, which is broadcast on Télé-Québec in Quebec. And before that, Véronique actually did work for TVO a long time ago. She was also the first president of the World Federation of Science Journalists and a past president of the Canadian Science Writers Association. Welcome to you. And Chad Orzel is our representative from the vast world of new media. He is a blogger. He is a physicist. I guess he's a physicist first and a blogger second, right? Because as a physicist, he's employed by Union University in upstate New York, Schenectady. And his blog, Uncertain Principles, is one of the blogs you can access on scienceblogs.com, which is run by Seed Media. So welcome to you all, panelists, and welcome again to the audience. So I think... When I say science journalists and science communication, I guess maybe we should explain a little bit of the difference between that, and maybe I'll ask Nadia if you want to say, if someone says to you, well, you're a science journalist, isn't that being a science communicator? What's the difference?
Well, for me, when you say that science journalist and science communicator, I'd see that there would be a difference. The way that I see the terms and the meaning that I give to them is that a science journalist is the person that is critical about the material that they cover in science, health, environment, and technology, and that they communicate their material through the media, but they have a critical analysis and approach to what they're writing. A science communicator, we do communicate science, so we are science communicators, but when we use the term science communicator, usually it refers to maybe press officers and communications officers in science institutions, and usually those that type of a career, they usually have, you know, they're communicating science from a specific point of view.
And it's one of those things I think that we all have to face. I mean, as we love science, we like to communicate science, but as journalists, you're also looking at it through a different lens, and I guess that lens is what you're talking about. Where would you say that lens is shining right now in Quebec with your work?
Well, I was gonna say the rule of thumb is when I go to bed, I always think when I do stories, I always think, well, who did I serve today? And if I can answer, I serve the public, I feel I've done my job as a journalist. I think that's the rule of thumb of to differentiate what communication is versus what journalism is. So that when communicators are writing, they're doing a great job, but you have to ask yourself, who is benefiting from what they're writing? And when a journalist is writing a story, his main purpose, his main intent is to serve the public.
The public interest.
But that doesn't answer your question about Quebec.
We have lots of time for that, don't worry. Ivan?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say the same thing, but the metaphor that I use, we like to use metaphors in this business, is it's like you live in, I mean, because when I was a student, I really thought I'm going to be a scientist. That was the whole point. I used to watch Nova. I had a cassette tape recorder up against the television whenever Cosmos was on with Carl Sagan so that I could play back the cassettes and listen to it. I mean, that was sort of, I was going to go and be an astronomer. And it didn't quite work out that way, which was interesting because I loved the content. And then I went into something that was more like communication. I did that for years at the Ontario Science Center. Although I did think of it even at the Science Center in terms of the public interest, because I was a civil servant. You know, how was I serving the public in that way? But then I became a journalist. I actually started to call myself a journalist. And I would call it like having a different, it's like living in the same town, but having a different passport. You know, what is your identity actually? And I've always feel like I've always lived in this on the same street, kind of space street or whatever, or space and earth or something, but my passports have changed. And I don't think I'm, well, we'll see. I don't know where it's going to go in the future. It hasn't changed. I'm experimenting with sort of a new kind of journalism in which I'm essentially, I have a patron. The patron is actually a university department. So I get to, it's not a permanent posting, but I get to spend time among scientists, find out what they're really doing up close. What I write is up to me. I have editorial independence, so it's a little bit like, you know, Mozart having a patron, or I'm not going to compare myself to Mozart, but you know what I mean?
You're a bit old now. Right. Right.
But I'm looking for my Franz Joseph, if you know what I mean. So.
Well, Chad, you're the, I wouldn't say odd man out, but we don't expect you to see things as a journalist. What would you say differentiates you?
Well, I would think that it's interesting to me that in talking about these terms, as a scientist, when I hear someone use the phrase science communicator, I think of people more like, you mentioned Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, people like that who are primarily scientists who work to educate the public about the science that they do, and who are, so I see the difference as being more, people I would consider science communicators are people who do science and then communicate that science. They're primarily scientists who also are communicators, whereas science journalists, I would say, are people who are primarily writers who are communicating with scientists. And science journalism, I think, plays an absolutely critical role in getting news about science, getting critical information about science to a broad audience. But I think that the what I think of as communicators is a slightly different angle. I don't think so much of sort of press offices and public relations. I think more of people who do you know, educational shows, who write popular audience books, and that sort of thing is more what I think of as communicators.
Well, it's interesting because in the case of science journalists, I know one, Steve Miller and Jane Gregory, who write about this, say they always tell scientists when, you know, push comes to shove, basically science journalism is more about journalism than it is about science. And I think in that sense, you, as a journalist, you apply the same standards and practices, that is, you know, integrity of intellect, I guess, intellectual honesty is a way of doing it, fairness, balance, following the money, attempting to be a filter between those who, as Dan Gardner, I think, said, would manipulate you and the public, that's you, and those who would manipulate you. And that filter, he said, is very thin at the moment. So I think that's an interesting thing.
In the past, though, too, right? Because, you know, the history of science journalism go back 50 years. And it was not, like back to World War II and a little further. I mean, their perception, and I think the reality was that the kind of science that was being written about by journalists in the media was very much kind of booster and fan club, totally fan club.
You're trying to avoid the pitfalls of cheerleading science. I mean, science is great, but...
Yeah, you wouldn't do it if you didn't like science, I don't think, right?
But there's always a but. Scientists will admit to it also. You have to remain critical and look at science with an observer's lens.
I'm sure already people are confused even by all these distinctions, because I imagine people just thinking, well, wait a minute, you write about science, don't you love science? Don't you just want as much of it as you possibly, you know, aren't you pro? And it's very tricky to split these hairs because, of course, pro-science, I think, but then when you kind of get into the details, but, you know, exactly who do I represent? For me, the final, you know, when you were talking about going to bed at night, what you think about, for me, it's like, it's bringing clarity to the world. Mm. It's bringing clarity to a complicated world for the public, because I think that serves the public good. That's the ultimate motivation.
And there's also areas where just being a cheerleader for science is not going to cut it, because there are questions of society that society has that you're supposed to be asking as an agent for them to really try and, as you say, clarify it, to look who's behind certain funding, to look at the research and see if it actually is considered solid research and learn how to read surveys, learn how to read studies, all these things that you don't necessarily learn in journalism school. Well, now you do, but maybe you didn't at one point. But it's interesting as well because we're speaking from a Western perspective here, and I'd like to hear from Nadia as well and how science journalism is unfolding in the Middle East and how that's changing, because journalism itself is changing in this country. Yeah.
Well, we have a very long history, in parts of the Arab world anyway, of science journalism. It might be interesting to know that science journalism in Egypt, for example, started way back in the 1700s when Napoleon Bonaparte was in Egypt. And he started in cooperation with the Egyptian Academy of Sciences at that time, a magazine, a cultural magazine, that included covering science for the general public. So we've had journalism for a very long time, especially in Egypt. Egypt is very strong in science journalism compared to other Arab countries. So in terms of quality, or quantity actually, we have had a long history, and we also have many different science sections in our newspapers now when we come to contemporary history. We actually have in Egypt a satellite television channel for science. And then you have in different Arab countries, you also have some science sections in newspapers, some popular science magazines. So we have, it's there. But the problem that we have is actually in quality. Even though we have this long history, I think we're still learning the profession. We're still learning how not to be cheerleaders. I think that's an important point. A lot of people that are covering science in our part of the world have some sort of a science background, so they do a lot of activism, basically. Sometimes it's difficult to tell, are they journalists or are they activists? Are they promoting it, or are they trying to be analytical and critical about what they're covering? And just as journalists in general, regardless of the fact that we're specialized in science in particular, we have some general journalism issues. One of them, I would say, is language. Science is usually communicated in the English language, is taught in the English language. In the Arab world, the English language is not the dominant language, Arabic is. And so it's very difficult for our journalists to be able to find out what's happening in the scientific world, and to be able to communicate with scientists because they're two different languages, completely different languages. And that affects the quality of the journalism that you see in our part of the world. And that's just one of the problems that we face. Another problem would be just how to be critical rather than to promote the material as it is.
It's interesting when you're talking about critical, and I guess you're saying, what's that really mean? And sometimes there's blogs I read that are critical as well. I mean, not all blogs are cheerleading blogs. So I just thought, in the new media world, where would you see that role?
Yeah, I'd say if you looked at blogs and sort of new media generally, is probably much more critical stuff than cheerleading stuff in a lot of respects. It's really easy to, if you have to come up with something to put on a blog, it's really easy to come spit out a 1,500 word rant about how wrong somebody was about some little aspect of some experiment that they were describing in the paper, and that's. It's harder to be positive and still be balanced and not be, just rah-rah cheerleader stuff. And it takes a little more work. So you do see a lot of often intensely negative commentary, people being, more ranting almost than writing in a more typical way.
So. Which I guess I should ask Ivan if that's the case where it's easier to be a ranter as a blogger than it is to be, well, obviously, an objective journalist, non-ranter.
I think in science, well, I'm not sure if I... So Chad, do you mean, like, ranting about experiments and ranting about science?
Frequently there's a very popular subgenre of science blogs that's ranting about science journalism.
The reason I'm asking is I think ranting lends itself well to cultural criticism. Yes. And you can see a lot of the ranting and the kind of the culture wars over creationism and evolution. But I was going to say one of the challenges in being critical you know, because we talk about how journalists want to be critical and so on. But I mean, let's face it, it's pretty hard to be critical about quantum information theory. Like, how do I know if this? And just to give you some reality here, Joe Palca, who reports for NPR, very well-known National Public Radio correspondent, once went back over his whole career, I don't know how many years at this point it was, to look at all of the medical studies he'd reported on to see, you know, in the end, all of these different results and trends and ideas about, you know, a cure for this, a cure for that, or you know, where is this going, where is that going, just to see how many of those things actually panned out into, you know, how many results of studies actually turned into something more. You want to guess what percentage of what he found?
It's going to be a very small number.
Zero.
Zero. All the big advancements, you know, in terms of what led to. So, you know, and peer review among scientists, even that doesn't filter out what's good or not. So it's pretty hard as a journalist to comment on good science. But certainly the interaction between science and culture and society and, you know, well, I mean, it requires examination. So I think there's a role for people who are coming at it at least with the point of view that this needs to be explored.
But I mean, blogging and reporting is very different. I mean, these are two different beasts. When you sit down to blog, you just bring what pops in your mind, right? And
well, it depends. I mean, sometimes it's...
Which I'm sure is great.
Yeah.
But
you know, my fallback is baby pictures. So yeah.
but or your dog.
Which is charming, so, right?
Yes.
No one's going to fault you for that.
No.
But when we go out in the field to do a story, we're trying to remain objective. We're trying to talk with as many different scientists, different perspective. If it's a new discovery, which are very few, but if it's a new advancement, a progress in science, we're trying to get different points of views. And of course, it's a different technique, a little bit, covering science than other types of journalism. I often, for instance, coach scientists before doing interviews to make sure that it will be, you know, simplified, that the answer will be comprehensible. So there's that thing that we bypass. Usually, it's a rule that we don't overcome. In that.
And we don't only speak with scientists and experts. No. We also go to people on the ground, and we want to know how this science is affecting your daily lives. We speak with policymakers and try to find out what they think about the science. So we get different points of views from different types of people, different categories of people. But when a scientist writes about his own science, when a science communicator is communicating about the science, usually they don't go to all of these different types of people.
So, but I think the thing that there are advantages to the sort of blogging scientist sort of model. In particular, there are a couple of things going on. There's a researchblogging.org, which was set up through the efforts of Dave Munger, who's also on Science Blogs, who runs a blog called Cognitive Daily, where he, you know, every day basically writes up a research paper. And he and his wife is a cognitive scientist at Davidson College, and they go through it, and they go to the original research articles, and because they have the science background, they can do that. And research blogging is an expansion of what they do at Cognitive Daily, which is there's over 100 blogs now, I believe, that of people who have registered with it, and they write up peer-reviewed research papers using the fact that they're scientists and they can read the technical articles and they can comment on it on a technical level. And there are some science bloggers who do an absolutely fabulous job. Dave is one. Ed Yong runs a blog called Not Exactly Rocket Science, which is he primarily writes about biology does the same thing. Sort of every day is writing up technical papers in a way that's comprehensible to a more general audience, but drawing on the fact that he's a scientist and can himself interpret he has a science background and can himself interpret what's going on in his
well,
papers.
See, but we definitely need both.
Yeah.
Don't get us wrong. We need the role of the science journalist and we need the role of the science communicator. It's just that they have different roles and they come from different backgrounds.
And what's been degrading in the past few years is the science journalism because of guys like you. No. not you, but because
it's not my fault.
Because of the advent of internet and what we know and the restructuring in the media and the recession, and there's been a lot of layoffs, and so it's a good time to get rid of science journalists, which haven't been replaced. But what I find through the last 20 years I've been in this business is that it goes in cycle. Don't you find this also, Catherine?
I'm not sure it's a cyclical thing as much as it's in this case, because we've got a really strong alternate source of information for people who like science news and science views, and for those who used to criticize science journalists sometimes for not being as investigative or not being as deep as they could be, you've got these wonderful kind of coteries of bloggers that do that. But at the same time, you've got other people on the internet that are actually sort of anti-science or pseudoscientists getting as much action as anyone else. So where do you find your trusted sources? Who is putting the sort of aggregate trust level on them? I think that's a new role for science journalists, is to be those the people who direct the public to people like you, because they're supposedly seeing this through the filter of public interest. So do you think there is a role for journalists and bloggers and these type of people to get together and somehow use traditional media to get this across, or are traditional media phasing out not just science journalists, but journalism as we know it already?
I think the really critical thing that is lost with the decline of science journalism, loss of science sections and newspapers and things like that, is that the blogosphere has a lot of great stuff in it. There are people who write absolutely brilliant blogs about science, and you can get fantastic, high-quality science news from there. But people have to know that they want to go to the blogs and get it. And to a large extent, you're losing sort of the serendipitous effect of the person who's flipping through the paper looking for, you know, the sports scores, or you know, as a friend of mine says, you know, did Garfield eat the lasagna this week? And happens to, you know, oh, amazing new medical breakthrough, you know, on the way to something else. And you don't. You get some of that in the blogosphere through big social aggregator sites and so on, but that's a very chancy, random thing, and frequently is not rewarding people for doing good quality stories about science. And it's more like, here's a really quirky thing that we found that, you know, that 100,000 people from FARC.com will click on the link and say, oh, neat, and then go away. How to leverage that into getting more information to a broader audience is difficult.
Yeah,
and I think with journalism shaking down a bit in the traditional sense, there'll be some very interesting things happening. I think we're in the middle of it right now, so we're sort of here to predict a little bit about what we think will happen. Ivan, you look like you want to say something.
I want to quote something from John Rennie, who's the former editor of Scientific American. And I saw him on a panel similar to this, basically saying the paradox is, from the public perspective, there's more access to great scientific information than ever in the history of the world. There's just no doubt about it. There's so much wonderful stuff out there. It's great. For the people who do it professionally, there is this incredible problem right now, which most people don't have to worry about, but if you happen to be in the profession, it's an issue. So for science journalists, it's a problem. But, you know, this all is about the internet, and the internet is all about breaking down boundaries. And from what I can see in just the time that I've been involved in this kind of work, three important boundaries have disappeared. One is who's doing it, which is what we've talked about. You know, basically, it allows everyone the access not only to publishing, but now to broadcasting. It's so easy with YouTube to do your own TV show. So there's one boundary gone. The other is the national boundaries, especially you know, newspapers, radio shows. They used to have regional or national audiences. Now you can go online and listen to science radio shows from around the world. So there's a kind of, you know, that division isn't there. There's a third one too, if I think of it. Oh, and just between the media, you know, used to be a print journalist or a broadcast journalist. Now the internet is somehow turning all of those things together into some new form. So all of that is actually very positive, because great new forms of communication are coming out of it. The one thing the internet doesn't seem to be able to do, I mean, the web can do pretty much everything. You want to know how to, you know, cook eggs or something, but the one thing it can't do is fund original content.
That's it. That's
you know, it's an amazing distributor of information. It doesn't pay for original material.
And that's what people will tell you in the, who are in the traditional media, that a lot of things are you know, comments on what they've read in the paper or seen on TV or anything else. So you take away that original source, where does it come from? Now you're looking at different models, foundation-funded journalism, not-for-profit journalism, university-funded journalism, and then it's all this question, well, is it really journalism if there's a client paying for it, right? Your patron.
Right.
Now, that might be a little bit of an abstract argument, but just for the sake of tossing it out there, I think, is it journalism?
There's also, to some extent, though, the traditional print media has lately failed to be able to support much of anything. You see a lot of newspapers, you know, either radically scaling back everything, not just science. Yeah. Science is one of the things that happens to be easy to cut, but
to there are, quote you know. Somebody else from that same panel, I think there was John Rainey, there was also James Harding of the Times. He said, the future looks bright for science journalism. He said that actually the third story that got the most readership in last year was the one about the Large Hadron Collider. The third story, after Obama.
And the recession, or the economy crash.
So they're planning to actually expand their science section, the Times of London.
That's good. I mean, there is an audience for it. I have a hard time sometimes looking at things at you know, science sections and media, CNN closing their science bureau, whatever. I look at that and say, you know, how can they possibly be losing money on this when, you know, Mythbusters is, like, hugely popular. Yeah. People, you know... I guess the science journalists need to do more stories about things that explode. But
Discovery does explode.
Oh, yeah. So. Definitely have a lot of. But I think the other thing that another way of looking at the web is that you know with a newspaper there's like there used to be a science section. If the New York Times was still a science section, but mostly that's not true anymore. There's a sports section, a life section, and so on. But actually, I'm sure most of you, if you really sort of explore your internet habits. You know, the internet is the newspaper. You know what I mean? You don't have to go to the sports section of a particular media outlet. There are all kinds of things that serve sports interests. And there are things that serve science interests as well. So even though the science sections are disappearing in newspapers, if you think of the internet as a whole, there's a huge domain of science that's ready to go, you know, ready to be explored.
There's also another area, though, about the people who put that product on the internet, whether they be bloggers, whether they be traditional journalists working in a journalism outlet or new journalists working for the nonprofit journalist model. But the question I have is, how do you make a living if you aren't doing it for a company that actually pays or a traditional journalism enterprise where you had a community of like-minded people who had some protection from legal assaults. They had some way of actually protecting their journalists from all kinds of problems they might run into. You actually had the backup of an editor who liked you to do a story that might be difficult or take longer to do because you were working on an investigative piece. Or in general, just the whole community, whether it's unionized or not, in most newspapers, television stations, were to protect you from the vagaries of the market. How do you do that as a blogger if you didn't have a real job?
I have a day job,
So is there a problem there?
I think there is. There's not. You can't make all that much money selling ads on your typical website. A small number of people make a very nice living at it, but it's not something that will support a really large community of people. And I don't think nobody's really found a good way to monetize much of anything on the internet.
So I won't start my blog tomorrow. So. But I can tell you that as a freelancer, how things have changed. I was, you know, thinking coming here, and 20 years ago, I was working for a show on TV Ontario. I recognized some of the guys here. I knew, and we were complaining all the time that we didn't have enough resources, not enough cameras. And here I am 20 years down the road working for a science show, also for television, but produced by a private company, bought by a public network. So there's like a filter in between. And we have less resources, less time, and we still do it. I don't know. Is it a miracle? Is it because I've got better at it? I'm not alone in that in that boat. But things have changed, but by the same token, there's less resources, but there are more outlets. So as a freelancer, I have more choices to sell my stories to. And I can tell you that so far I've had nobody mingling with my content. And for instance, when I write for television, we write 20 versions, perhaps, for a story, a six-minute story. It goes through the pipeline of 10 different people, up from the top to, you know, and the 20th version always comes back to me. So that's respect for the science journalist work, and that's comforting.
What's not comforting?
Why is not comforting? Well, you will never be rich doing this job, but I don't think anybody...
You won't get rich as a scientist.
Exactly. I mean, you do it because you believe in it. Mm-hmm. You know, you believe that you bring a bit of clarity.
Well,
at the end of the day.
Scientists and journalists all have to ask the right questions, and they have to be the good questions. So we have that in common, which is a really good thing. The question, I think, too, that we have to think about is how, as Tom Rosenstiel said, who's the project for journalism, excellence in journalism, that journalism is changing from a product, something that you pick up in the newspaper or see on television news or whatever, into a service. In other words, you are going to give people what they need to know as a service. In other words, you will be the filter. You will be the one who says, not those guys, listen to these guys, or watch these guys, or this is a bit shady. You will actually be pushing people towards the sources that they can trust. Because ultimately, we believe in enlightened citizenship. That's why you become a journalist, because you want the public to have a fighting chance against powers that are bigger than they are, right? So do you think that we could actually formulate a kind of journalism that does just that? I mean, picking up on the fact that the model has to change, picking up the fact that we need the blogosphere, we need the good bloggers to be part of us. Do you think how would that happen, do you see, in your world?
Well, the context I come from is a context where we're still very traditional. You're talking about what's happening in the West. It's not, what you're talking about is not happening where I come from. And I think, actually, we're complaining about the fact that we're not having enough scientists who are blogging. And we don't have enough science communicators in our part of the world. And we're not changing and developing and maturing in the way that we communicate science and in using these new tools that are available the way that you guys are doing. So your complaints are very different from our complaints, actually. We're extremely traditional in the way that we're covering science, and we need to start being able to have these kinds of complaints that you guys have. I wish we could complain these complaints.
But isn't it true that in the Islamic world and India and China, all of these places, science reporting is on the rise?
It is, right? On the rise, but it's on the rise
traditionally.
Oh, definitely.
For the reason that we want it to be on the rise, or is it on the rise because governments are paying a lot of lip service to it, and therefore they want the reporters to say good things about their science?
No. It's on the rise because our governments are finally paying attention to the importance of science, and science is starting to happen in a big way in our countries, and that's why it's new. That's why it's increasing, and so there's something more to cover now. We have a lot of science conferences now, international science conferences happening in the Arab world. And again, that gives us an opportunity to cover more. So it's happening. It's just that we need to start using the newer tools.
Mm-hmm. And there's money to finance some of it as well, right? I
mean, well, it's of course, in the Gulf region, there's money to finance it, yes.
And any country really that's taken science seriously has to start taking science communication seriously. And journalism is a part of that until it gets into trouble, but normally
Let me tell you what our real problem is. Our real problem in the Arab world is not that we don't have science journalists, and it's not that we don't have the outlets in which to publish the science that we want to write about. Our problem is actually finding a way to find out what's happening within our science institutions. Our science institutions are basically, they're closed to the general public. And the example that I always give is that it's really easy for me while I sit at my desk to know what's happening within your science institutions in Canada or in the United States or in Europe, because I get press releases and I get emails and I can go onto their websites very easily. But I can't find out easily or as easily what's happening within the science institution that's right across the street from me. And even if I go and I physically take myself and knock on the doors, within the institution itself, there's not this internal communication where people know what each other, what every single person within the institution is doing. So it's hard for us to get the information that we need to be able to cover the science that's happening internally. And the result of that is that a lot of our science coverage is actually copying what you guys are doing. So we're writing about the science that's happening in the West rather than writing about the science that's happening in our own part of the world.
So why is that, do you think? Why is it
as closed as that? It's a disconnect. We still, as a system, we don't realize the importance of science communication. We know that science is important, we're realizing that covering it in the media is important, but we don't know that there's a bridge in between that the science journalists need and the scientists need in order to get that science out there into the public and to us.
I think that's there's still a little bit of trouble with that in the West. I think there's one of my things that I tend to go off on rants about is academic culture and the way that it you know, communicating science to a broad audience is not particularly well rewarded within the professional structure of academia. That you get tenure for writing papers that appear in Science, not articles that appear in Scientific American. And that creates, in a lot of cases, a disincentive for scientists who would be interested in speaking to a very broad audience to do that. You'll find people who advise young scientists starting as faculty not to start a blog because that might, people will see that as a distraction from the work that you ought to be doing, and that will, potentially harm your chances of getting tenure, your chances of promotion, your professional career.
I find that incredible now.
Because, really?
I mean, I can see that, a generation ago, but it just seems now, everyone is so media savvy. Mm. All organizations are media savvy, and they're carefully monitoring their media profile.
Yeah, we're in the ivory tower.
Wouldn't a university want to be recruiting, someone who's a superstar or has a public profile?
There's a weird difference, though. Like the part of the university that wants the high-profile things, that wants splashy media coverage, is not the same part of the university that is the professional, societies and the organizations for physicists, in my case. Organizations like that are, the scientists themselves tend to regard, and this is a cultural thing that's been, generations in the making, mm-hmm. tend to regard publication, in technical terms as the most important thing. And if, in your free time you happen to go off and give public lectures, that's a nice thing to do, but, your time would probably be better spent being in the lab or
so
thinking deep thoughts
out.
Somewhere.
But
I have tenure now, so
so you can do what you want. But Nadia, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because you're talking about that closed universe that you're experiencing. It's only started to break down in academia, really, in the last 20 years. And even so, I've still talked to scientists to say, there's no percentage in me talking to the media. It doesn't get my research published the right way I want.
My
colleagues think I'm like grandstanding. They don't like it. They sort of
jealous,
shun me. Yeah, they're jealous. Mm.
I think there is some, that is breaking down somewhat, and I think a really good example of that is the Large Hadron Collider was mentioned earlier, and I think that there really has been, I don't know that it's been spelled out as such, but the high energy physics community has really been among the leaders in blogging and things like that, and there are official blogs run by the United States Large Hadron Collider Collaboration. They, for the World Year of Physics in 2005, they had this Quantum Diaries project. They got physicists from around the world who are particle physicists to write blogs, And I think they really have realized that there is, in fact, a percentage in it for them, which is that if people don't think particle physics is really neat, then people don't pony up the billions of dollars that you need to build the next particle accelerator. And they got the particle physics, the high energy physics community got burned very badly by the superconducting supercollider back in the 90s, which was going to be the next big thing, and then Congress cut the funding. And I think part of what led to the funding cut was that it hadn't been sufficiently justified to a broad enough audience that it would be appreciated. And so the media blitz that surrounded the Large Hadron Collider has been, I think, in some ways a reaction to that. And I think that's a good sign for the
field
as a whole.
But the tragedy in this is that despite all the coverage by colleagues and of yours and physicists and blogs, despite this, a majority of people still think that it's dangerous, that it's going to suck the world. You know, if you would ask, why is that?
It's depressing how often that question comes up. I would direct anybody who is concerned about the danger to the Daily Show piece on where they had John Oliver at CERN and then talking to the person who was filing lawsuits to try and stop the turning on of the Large Hadron Collider, which really makes clear just what the validity of that idea is.
Yeah. I think it calls
Although
for...
one scientist said she would have been happy to see those small holes, little black holes. It would have been quite neat.
Oh, it would be neat to see, yeah.
You know, kidding aside, there is an interesting dilemma there for the science journalist because, you know, I mean, I've been in those conversations where people ask me, is it really going to end the world? And, of course, you just want to brush it off and say, no, it's not going to end the world. But then if they pursue it and say, okay, well, prove it to me, you know, like, really? How do you really know? And, you know, well, I guess because the scientist told me it's okay. So, like, and that's obviously not good enough, right? So I know at New Scientist, my former publication, New Scientist, where I still contribute, there was an effort to really kind of drill down in detail and just make sure that you can really do all the math and say, and this is why it's not a problem.
I mean, there are still people who believe that the moon landings were faked.
Right. Oh, well,
Certainly the internet has proliferated and given those guys a really strong voice that actually wasn't that strong before.
It
right?
lets them find each other. Yeah. I don't know that there are actually more of them. They can just communicate more easily.
But I think the main problem is that there's a lack of constant coverage in mainstream media of science. Mm. And there was an effect that is really well described by, I can't remember his name, and I'm sorry if he's listening, I don't think so. It's called the hoopla effect in science coverage, where you get a lot of coverage of a particularly interesting science event, such as this one, when it failed to turn on, and then you leave the public in a vacuum without any science coverage for the thing for months. And now it's going to start again, because the thing's going to start, we hope. We don't know, but... So that's the hoopla effect, is the fact that, you know, people are... The general public, most of us, 97% of people, who are more interested in, daily stuff. Huh? So they don't hear about science for months on end, and then suddenly they're loaded with science stories, and they get...
But there is the internet can help with this in that there is has the LHC destroyed the earth.com, which does publish daily updates on whether the LHC has destroyed the earth yet. So.
And I mean, whatever it is you're interested in online, there's a place, you know, there are blogs on LHC and so on that you could, if you wanted to follow it daily, you could. I mean, the problem is, I think, information overload. I mean, this is where I blog as well, and I struggle with it in a number of different ways. And one of them is, am I putting noise up? You know, like if I manage to put a blog up today, am I adding value to this vastly expanding universe of information or whatever it is that's out there? You know, and I'm feeling myself reining myself in. Like, maybe I don't want to write about this because maybe there's just too much of this already. And just try to, but you know, it's. I don't know what you think.
That is the classic dark night of the soul for the blogger is you know having the realization that am I actually just putting gibberish out there? A lot of people who start blogs go through that, which is why, you know, Technorati used to claim that they indexed 130 million blogs, and, you know, 129.5 million of them hadn't been updated in 3 months.
Right.
And a lot of people start blogs and then abandon them because of precisely that sort of thing. More people, the people who stick with it tend to find a niche. They tend to find, you know, there's a thing where I can really make a contribution. I mean, I started my blog in 2001 because I was reading a lot of political weblogs and decided not to just do politics. I do occasionally talk about politics, but decided not to do that just because there are 1,000 people doing that. But at the time, there was nobody who was writing anything about physics. And so I, the one science blog that I remember really liking was it's Derek Lowe, who writes, it's in the pipeline now. At the time, it was Lanyap. Had a blog, he's a pharmaceutical chemist working for a drug company, and wrote really interesting posts about what it's like to be a pharmaceutical chemist working for a drug company. And still does that, and you know, he has that niche, and that's a thing that works. And I saw that and said, you know, I can do the same thing with physics. I can talk about what is it like to be a experimental physicist at a small college on a tenure track, and that's kind of the thing that you find, and you go with that. And so
it's experiential.
But the thing about that too, though, is as someone said, if you look at a blog and you look at, say, you've got a list of maybe 1,000 people blogging on something, you come up and you look at the top 10, chances are you're only going to read one of them, right? So at some point there's going to be a cull,
You know, a lot of things. I mean, there are people who believe very strongly that this will all sort itself out through, you know, the magic of collective effects. That, you know, the best, the things that are the best will be linked to by everybody else, and so, you know, the 990 of the 1,000 that aren't that good will actually all be linking to the 10 that are, and so you'll be able to, you'll eventually filter your way down to the ones that are really good.
Is that physically possible?
I don't know if that, I'm not a huge proponent of that. I think that there is a lot of value in more traditional journalistic structures and having some, you know, institutional credibility.
To contrast, I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter and I do follow blogs. In Egypt, our blogosphere is completely political. And I've been searching for the past few months for Arab scientists who are blogging. Mm-hmm. I cannot find one. I sent an email out to 200 members of the Arab Science Journalists Association. Guys, do you know any Arab scientists who are blogging? I got absolutely no answer. And I found we have two science journalists who do have a science background. But those are the only two people that do have a blog that, you know, that addresses science in one way or another. But other than that, I can't find anything.
It's
a completely different context.
Different tradition, or maybe the fear of talking too much, being muzzled?
A lot. No, we have no problem talking.
No? Okay.
No.
Well, you know, it happens everywhere.
There's a thriving political.
It's actually becoming a problem in Egypt, especially the political blogosphere. It's rampant with discussions about, you know, taboo topics that we haven't talked about ever in the Arab world. But science is not one of the things that we're talking about at all in the blogosphere.
Can you inject that into the political scene? I mean, science does have a political or policy element to it.
Well, it could be, but it's not happening.
No.
It's just not happening yet.
Hmm. Well, so if I speculate, is there a potential that there's a kind of separateness that scientists see from society, you know, that they do their thing and they don't...
I think it's about the fact that our scientists still haven't, they're not comfortable, they haven't learned the importance of communicating science to a general public. It's not there yet. They're very closed in on themselves and on their own, you know, their own work. I think maybe part of it is that life in our part of the world is just so difficult and they're just so enthralled in just making a living, being able to feed their kids, that they don't have time to go back home and start, you know, blogging on the internet. When would they find time for something like that? In Egypt, in Cairo, it takes 2 hours just to get to work and
That's
2 hours
true.
To get back. So, you know, by the time you're home, you're really tired and you want to watch a television soap opera or something, not sit down on the internet and blog about science.
But, you know, the system, such as it is now, with people able to blog, and we've got, as you know, so many good science blogs, and it will come about, I would imagine, as people get used to the idea that maybe it's a science journalist. One of the things that always surprises me now is we've got lots of programs in the United States, a few in Canada, more in Europe now than before, that are turning out science journalists, right? Journalists with some specialty in science and whatnot. Now, they aren't necessarily getting jobs in the media because, A, if they're not replacing the science journalists who are retiring, then there's no place for them to go. And so they're working in all kinds of different areas, and a lot of them work online because that is where they do have value because they're so media savvy with online. But surely there must be a point where all of these new people who love this discipline of science journalism will start banding together to some degree and doing more work. And I see that happening just with like the World Federation's programs and different things like that, they won't remain silent for long. Now, the only problem there is that a lot of them are getting picked up by research organizations to be writing their press releases that they send to the media who are overworked and often pick them up. So that's where I see there's a disconnect. The marketing side of the research organizations, the marketing side of government institutions and that just employ the journalists to write really well and send it out with their message. Do you see a problem there?
Well, I'm wondering about how sophisticated this is getting. I mean, the Quantum Tamers, you know, if for those of you who've seen this wonderful film, good as anything you could get on a broadcaster, and I can't imagine how hard it would be for me to sell a broadcaster on, you know, let's do a documentary about quantum computing. So what happens? The institution where scientists are doing that work, they're just going to do their own documentary, and it's as good as anything you can see out there. It's as good as anything you can see. So then, if you're a professional, where does that leave you? Who are you working, you know, who do you work for?
And the same phenomenon happened with CNN. There was a panel back in London with a guy from National Science Foundation, which is the biggest funding agency in the U.S., and they said they were starting to put up their own programs, and they're actually in discussion with the CNN, who had laid off its science department, to start a new science program, so the public will not see the difference. And meanwhile, the science journalists are no longer staff, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a danger there, of course. Yeah.
Well, as I say, we're in these transitional times, so there will be a shakedown. The public, as far as the public goes, I guess they're getting access to some very interesting science at the same time. Where I think there'll be a difference is whether or not they're getting the kind of critical appraisal of these things, and maybe it's not even all that necessary all the time. We live in a fairly open democracy. If you don't have scientists that understand policy, and if it's the government that's impeding the science, maybe that's where we need to get more scientists and journalists trained, right?
It's also, you know, there's an interesting parallel in some ways to between the situation of science journalists and the situation of scientists, in that a problem that lots of young scientists talk about is that the job market is horrible, that there are many times more PhDs produced in any given year than there are positions for them to take after graduation. So you have people, particularly in more theoretical areas, doing, you know, 2, 3, 4 postdocs, spending a long time in kind of a limbo. And I've heard some people suggest that what, you know, you could sort of kill two birds with one stone and improve science communication while also improving the lives of those people by getting, you know, the scientists who are being underemployed to do science communication. The counter argument to that is usually that just is a total disaster for the journalists. and I don't know, but you know, everybody is being squeezed in very similar ways.
And well, that would be probably tragic. Tragic, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, but that suggests that if someone who can't get a tenure track position stepped into journalism, that immediately the journalists would be dumped in favor of this person. So it's not really like that, of course, because in the end, it's still about telling a good story. So it's a different skill set. You may have it if you're a scientist, great, but you also might not.
I think, you know, scientists, the communication skills of scientists are often underrated in that. You literally cannot be a successful scientist without being able to communicate to an audience. If you can't write a comprehensible paper, if you can't deliver a good talk at a scientific meeting, you'll go nowhere. And so scientists do learn how to communicate. We learn how to communicate to a very specific audience, which is to say other scientists.
Right, and we're here to make sure that you can communicate to the world at large and that we actually see how you do that and help you do it because we want the message to get across. But we also want to give the audience a chance to ask some questions of us now, too. So before we do that, I'd really like to thank you all for your contribution. I know we could keep this up for a long time. Nadia El-Awadi, Ivan Semenek, Veronique Morin, and Chad Ortez, thank you all for your contribution tonight. And do we have any questions from the audience? Ah, we have Jennifer on the internet. The blogosphere responds.
Yes, we do. Phil from Toronto asks, are we better served by having someone trained as a scientist learn to become a reporter, or having a reporter attempt to learn to understand the subject they're reporting on, clearly related to what you guys were just talking about?
That's a question that gets asked often by scientists. Wouldn't it be better if they had a scientific background if they were going to ask me questions, right? Which again, I think you can respond to that.
Yeah, I wanted to address what we were talking about just now. I worked as an editor for a few years, and as an editor, many scientists would approach me and ask me if they could publish an article on our website. And of course, I would encourage that. But in my experience, and I'm talking Arab world, that the scientists were the worst communicators. And it's true. And it reached the point where I just completely stopped accepting articles from the scientists. And it was the journalists that needed some training in order to understand the background of the science that they're writing about. But because they were already good communicators, you could train them to do that. It was extremely difficult to explain to our scientists, at least. It might be different in the West, but it was extremely difficult for our scientists to learn how to communicate this complex science in a simple way using journalistic standards to a general audience.
But I think that's not entirely fair to put that all on the scientists. I think that the problem is the same in both cases, in that scientists are trained very well to communicate to an audience of other scientists. Journalists are trained very well to communicate to a general audience. Journalists generally do not do a good job of communicating to scientists. It's just that there are far more people in the general public, in the audience that journalists are trained to communicate to. There's a lot more of them than there are of the scientists.
But you know, as an editor, I want a news story, or I want a feature article. Mm-hmm. I want the person that's writing that article to go and to speak to several scientists, to speak to policymakers, to speak to a few guys on the street. The scientist won't do that for me. Scientist wants to sit down and write about the science that he's doing, and then throw it onto the website.
But to address the question we have from the audience, member.
Belly. I had the pleasure to have a conversation with John Maddox, who died last year, who used to be editor-in-chief of Nature, which is a very credible and very, you know, serious science journal. And I asked him that question, which comes first, the scientist or the journalist, when it comes to convey science information? And he answered to me, the journalism is more important.
So I've always thought it's like, the science is like the town where you come from, and journalism is like the vehicle that you drive. So if you're sending someone to Science Town, if you're an editor, and you're sending someone to Science Town to cover a story, it's great that they were born there and they know everything, but if they don't have a driver's license, they can't get there. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, once they do have, however, I have to modify that, because after years of doing this, if you have the driver's license, but you are also from there, it's a really potent combination, mm-hmm. as long as you know where you're coming from.
Yeah, and Catherine, I come from a science background. But what I did is that I went and I got a master's degree in journalism. So when you combine the two, it helps a lot.
Yeah, I think that the jury is out on whether it's essential. I don't think it's essential. You have to still know how to do journalism, but I think the difference is it is helpful if you have a science background. On the other hand, there's so many specialists in science that even scientists don't understand what the fellow next door is doing or the woman across the hall. So you're always only one step removed from it as a journalist. You're still finding out a new story, how to tell that story, how to make it interesting. And again, as you say, when you're dealing with scientists, often you say, is this the right science? I mean, do I have the science part right? Not the editorial part, not the other part, not the storytelling part, but do I have the science right? You ask, right? That's all you can do.
I have one more question from the online audience. Keith from Sudbury says, thinking back over the years to huge media announcements about science that turn out to be overstated or premature, it's going back to an early stage in the discussion, how, as science journalists, do you prevent sensationalism?
How do you prevent sensationalism and start covering stories that get hyped from all kinds of sources, right?
It's and of course, as a journalist, it's out of your control because it's a collaborative enterprise. I mean, the amazing thing about blogging, of course, is you're your own editor. You can say whatever you want to say. You're responsible for it. But of course, you might paint something with all the caveats and all of the background. But then an editor might spike it up and kind of push it higher. How far can we go with this? Because in the end, we got to sell magazines, we got to sell newspapers, we've got to sell ads on the, you know. So that's, you just have to hold the line, integrity, all of those things come into play.
I would tell the gentleman or the lady, gentleman, that he has to choose his media. He has to choose the right magazine. You know, there are magazines that are there to sell sensationalism. And there are others that are there to produce really serious and interesting stories.
And I would say that, you know, this isn't a temptation. The temptation to be sensationalistic is not restricted to mainstream journalism. The bloggers who do make a living at it are generally supported by ad revenue in one way or another. And so there is a real incentive to, you know, I have this website, I can put whatever I want on it, but I would really like lots of other people to read it. And so there is a powerful temptation to post about things that lots of people will come read. And that shifts, you can see a certain evolution in a lot of blogs that start out being about one thing and you know, drift toward, you know, things and frequently in a way that's kind of unhealthy to talking about, you know, really sensationalistic things.
And research organizations, universities have their own public relations officers, public information officers, who normally can do a good job, but sometimes they get very excited. They have opportunities. There's a pressure on them to sort of get the industrial partnerships running and going. So, you know, they're pushing in that direction for those very reasons. And, you know, if journalists fall victim to it, that we're trying to teach them not to do that. But as I said, it's a pressurized world out there.
I have a question.
Oh, sorry.
That we, in the World Federation of Science Journalists, we've been training journalists in Africa and the Arab world especially on the professional standards of journalism. And part of that is how not to be sensational when you approach a topic. So training is really important.
Training is, for sure. Okay, we have some questions here from the audience.
All right, so there are a lot of ideas out there that are very corrosive to science, like vaccines are bad for you, the Earth's only 5,000 years old, the Large Hadron Collider is going to cause a black hole, and I think it makes it a lot more difficult to communicate proper science, so how can we get around that?
Good question.
I, I'll just give you a short answer. Again, it goes back to mainstream. It goes back to the hoopla effect. I think if you keep people informed about science on a daily basis, that wouldn't happen because they would develop a taste. They would develop an ear for science. And I think we're getting there, but we're, you know, at the infancy. And that's why people are still interested, more interested about what I call the Lewinsky effect, or, you know, like the show, the celebrity, the things that are really not affecting their lives, or they're not really asking questions about how things work. And that's how people should start thinking. And the only way we can do that is with basic mainstream science journalism. That's my short answer.
There are people on weblogs who, you know, their niche is they sort of tirelessly refute these things as they come up. Respectful insolence on science blogs. Ben Goldacre's
Bad Science.
Phil Plait's Bad Astronomy. There are a lot of science blogs. There's about 10 people who do just climate change denialism. Countering, you know, whatever the latest, you know, humans are not causing global warming scam is, and people who do that. So there are a lot of people out there who fight the good fight, and I think all that you really can do is put the right information out there, and, you know, eventually it'll find its way to the people who need it.
Can I add one quick thing? I just have a subtle point to make here because, you know, at New Scientist, among other things, we covered a lot of the intelligent design debates and so on. It's a little bit different, I think, than the flu shot thing. And, because I felt as a journalist it wasn't my job to go, you know, of course, I'm happy to call out and say, look, the evidence is evolution. Everyone knows this. No scientist disputes it. But I don't feel like it's my job to stamp out this other segment of society that's pursuing this, because really it's my job to cover what's happening in society. So if scientists and non-scientists are debating over evolution, I want to be there, I want to be in the courtroom, I want to be covering it, I want to look at this entire phenomenon and think about what it means for society, but I don't necessarily want to pick up the flag and start crusading, because then you lose your objectivity.
Interesting. Thank you.
My question is about how much effort, or how do science journalists go about covering science news that hasn't already kind of been translated into English or into a first language like Arabic. So, for example, friends of mine who are in academia in Mexico often complain that if they can't get it published in English, they have to get it translated, get it somewhere, and get it published, because otherwise whatever research they've done basically goes unrecognized.
That's a great question. Yeah.
No, it might be one of those questions that has a tough answer, if any answer.
Science is very much written in English all over the world, and it used to be French, but a long time ago. But
German for a while.
Arabic way before that, right? So, yeah.
But in the Arab world, science is published in English. It's not published in Arabic. And that's the problem for our journalists. It's not a problem for the scientists. Well, it's also a problem for the scientists, because that's one of the reasons why our scientists find it difficult to get their research published in international journals, because their communication skills in the English language are not as strong as they should be in order to get, you know, a decent research paper written and then published. So they do have to translate. I don't know what the solution is. I think partly it's that you have to learn English. At this stage, we just have to deal with the fact that science is communicated in the English language.
Which is easy to say right now, but, you know, in another generation, that might be true for Chinese. Yep. And we're all going to have to think really hard about that.
And of course, the Chinese are all learning English, so they're going to have double whammy there. They can do the Chinese and the English, and if we only can do one, we might be process of elimination. Question?
Yes, when you were talking at the very beginning of the panel about criticality and science journalism, in what sense of the word critical do you mean? Criticality is quintessential to the pursuit of science, but there's also a lot of like fake critical attitudes that wind up getting propagated, and it's not clear to me exactly how you mean that you are bringing criticality to talking about science.
The term critical is a scientific term.
I'll give a really specific example, which is climate change. And the criticality doesn't mean that the journalist says, some people say the climate's changing and some people say it isn't. It's not like that. It's being able to, because of course among scientists, you can never get two scientists to agree on anything scientific. I mean, I'm sure. It's very, everyone has a slightly different opinion. So for the journalist, the role is to kind of take the measure of what the entire community is saying and try to represent this is what it, this, to the best of my knowledge, this is what it is.
And another example would be that the science journalist needs to have a role in finding out, if we're talking about research, who funded that research, for example. And, you know, because that has an impact on the results of the research paper itself and how we interpret these research results.
Yeah, it's following the money, it's weighing the evidence, weighting, giving it weight, not necessarily balance. I think that's all the time we have for this discussion. Thank you again so much. Thank you, audience, for being here. Thank you, Perimeter Institute, for putting a new bar, raising the bar for science communication, and letting us science journalists have our say as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are going into a rehearsal now, so we would just appreciate if you could leave by the front door. Much, much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The panelists will be out to talk to you in the hall.
And just a reminder that you're all welcome to come up and enjoy the ambiance of the Black Hole Bistro, continue the discussion with audience members and some of our guests who will be up shortly. So the Black Hole Bistro is on the fourth floor. Take a right-hand turn when you come off the elevator.